Hello everyone and welcome to episode 11 of Sportspiel, the podcast where the sporting analysis is just as sharp as the end of that crossbow bolt that was fired into the ground at the Oval. Joining me, Alistair Hooper as ever, to chat all things sport is Mr. Will Moulton, fresh from his first week in his new job.
I'm back. I wouldn't say fresh. Getting up at 5 every morning, commuting for 3 hours each way is difficult, but it's worth it.
I do not envy you.
Yeah, but it's worth it to be working in a job I've always wanted to do, so I'm a happy man, happy that we're recording once again, and I did like that cricket analogy.
Wasn't that one of the weirdest stories you've ever seen?
Yes. It's also the fact that no one knows who did it.
Still
no one knows who did it.
If you are new to the podcast, this is how it works. Myself and Will will discuss some of the big sports talking points from the last couple of weeks in our first section, around about 20 minutes or so. On this episode, we're going to talk a little bit about the achievements of Chris Froome, who has just become the first cyclist to win both the Vuelta a España and the Tour de France in the same year since Bernard Hinault did it in 1978. Primarily, we're going to ask why the Brit isn't quite as popular as he perhaps should be. After that, we're going to chat doping and Russia and the Winter Olympics. On Thursday, 17 national anti-doping agencies demanded that Russia should be banned from the 2018 Winter Olympics. We ask if they should be barred or if they should be allowed in. The second part of every Sportspiel episode is dedicated as the feature interview section where, either myself or Will, holds a one-on-one interview with a sporting star. On this episode, we're delighted to say that we're joined by British 100-metre sprinter Rhys Prescott, who shot into the public consciousness as he finished 7th at the IAAF World Championships just a matter of weeks ago. All that, and he is still just 21 and has been a professional for only 2 years. In the half-hour-long interview, Rhys tells us all about his career and also explains why the dark times he experienced have helped him to where he is now. He gives us an insight into that World Championship final as Justin Gatlin beat Usain Bolt to gold, and he tells us why he could so easily be an estate agent right now. All that and more on this episode of Sportspiel. Right, discussion section time. And we're going to kick off with Chris Froome. The British cyclist has had quite a 2017. In July, he claimed his 4th Tour de France title, but on September the 10th, 6 days ago as we record this, Froome went and became the first Brit ever to win the Vuelta a España. The victory means he is the first man to win the Tour Vuelta double in the same year since 1978 when Bernard Hinault did it, and he's just the third in history to do it, with Jacques Anquetil being the other member of that exclusive club. I really hope I pronounced that name right. Firstly, what a performance from Chris Froome, and he's now the first man to do the double.
Yeah, it's incredible. He's almost got to go down as the greatest British road cyclist of all time, hasn't he? Because what he's done is ridiculous. He's won, what, 4 Tour de France now. He's added this as his 5th major road race title. He's now targeting the Giro d'Italia. He's also won Olympic medals. Potentially, he could have done better at the Olympics. He's won 2 bronzes.
People would say that.
But you would like to think he could win a time trial gold. But he's won World Championships medals as well. So. The man's just a machine, isn't he? He's incredible.
Absolute machine. But we're going to ask the question as to why is he not appreciated in quite the same way as other British sporting stars? Say Mo Farah, but I suppose because we can compare the two, Bradley Wiggins as well. And you kicked off there with, is he quite possibly the greatest British cyclist of all time? But that's the first question that people always ask. Is he truly British? Because, of course, he was born in Kenya, 2 British parents, grew up there and then in South Africa, and he originally raced for Kenya until he switched to Great Britain in 2008-2009 time. And he said in 2008, although he was riding under the Kenyan flag, he made it clear that I'd always carried a British passport and felt British. But is that part of the reason why people don't really warm to him?
It's got to be, hasn't it? You know, you saw it before London 2012, all the stuff, especially in the newspapers about the plastic Brits, you know, the likes of Tiffany Porter, who had, you know, grown up in a foreign country but now representing Great Britain. You've seen it in the cricket and the rugby, what people think of the South Africans.
Every member of our wrestling team as well.
Same thing. You see like the South Africans and the Kiwis represent us, but the Kenya is a former British colony.
And he's British parents.
He has British parents, and you know, he might have grown up in a foreign country, but he has British parents in the form of in an English speaking country that, you know, has strong links with Great Britain, where you can easily get a British passport if you're born there as well. So I think that is a major, but it's one of the major things. I think there was a good piece by Matt Lawton on the Daily Mail website just after Chris Froome won, and asking all the questions as to why we might not think Chris Froome is as good as, you know, Bradley Wiggins or Chris Hoy. That was one of his major questions, is, you know, he wasn't born here, but there was also personality. He's a quiet man. It's also, you know, have Brits just turned off from road racing since Bradley Wiggins, or because of, you know, Lance Armstrong? And also, you know, is it because he's racing for Team Sky with all their doping accusations around them? There's so many factors that could explain why Chris Froome isn't quite as popular as he should be, because, you know, what he's done, we've got to assume he's clean, because, you know, there's never been any, you know, real proper legitimate allegations made against against him specifically, so we've got to assume he's clean. And he's won four Tour de France. He's won three in a row. The guy's insane. He's going to the Road World Champs later this month as well. Like, can we not just appreciate him for what he's doing?
Well, he's a definition of a machine. And this British thing, I always find it kind of annoying, because I don't think as onlookers you can truly judge for yourself if someone's British. I think it's up to that person. But I also think once they've decided, that's it. You stick with it.
Yeah.
Because nationality is very much down to the individual. If you ask from a personal point of view, ask my dad. He considers himself British, but he was born in Tanzania, brought up in Canada, now lives here. But to some people, he's probably not considered British. So it's really down to the individual, I think. And if they want to represent our country in sport and do well and be a role model, I'm perfectly happy with that. Compared to some people that probably can consider themselves British out there. It's a difficult one, and I think it's down to the own individual. But you mentioned personality, bringing in Bradley Wiggins here, because of course he was highly popular, but part of that was probably down to his extravagant personality and, you know, that mod look that he's got.
Yeah.
Perhaps not considered so popular now because of TUEs and accusations labelled in his direction there. Would you like to see more of an outgoing personality from Chris Froome, or should he just be who he is and not put on this fake facade in order to gain more popularity?
You've got to be who you are. There's no point pretending to and trying to be something you're not. And it's not, you know, you sometimes see Chris Froome on TV shows, on radio shows. I think he's done Question of Sport, you know, but he's naturally a very quiet, reserved bloke from what we see, who just wants to be professional and wants to train and wants to race, and that's what he's good at. So I can understand that it's not necessarily a personality you can warm to, but that's just who he is. You've just got to accept it. You can't force him to be something he's not.
And of course drug accusations and all the doping problems that cycling has had in the past has kind of made it a real tainted sport. And before we started recording this, both you and myself, we were looking at the list of banned cyclists and cyclists that are still racing now who have been banned in the past. And firstly, it's lengthy, but the most striking thing is all the high profile cyclists that we think of, say Nibali, we always have to think, has he been convicted for drugs? Has he had a drugs problem in the past? Sometimes they don't, but it kind of sets aside the mindset that we have to double check ourselves whether they have been convicted for drugs.
We were pulling up names like Alberto Contador, Vincenzo Nibali, Fabian Cancellara, and we were thinking surely at least one of them's got to have been done, and Quintana as well, the Colombian, and as far as we're aware, I think all of them are clean. Richard Porte as well, the Australian, I was adamant. I was like, sure, he got a 4-month ban. It wasn't him, it was someone else. But
Contador had drug problems.
Yeah,
he was just
recently
retired.
Contador did, but that was a while ago now, and he's still getting accused even now.
Yeah, and he had a tour title taken away from him.
He did have his 2010 tour title taken away, but he also won in 2007, 2009, and they haven't gone. So
exactly,
not a serial doper, still a doper though. But
so is that maybe the main reason then for Chris Froome not getting the praise that he probably deserves? Not obviously the British thing comes in, but the fact that people have turned off cycling, have turned off Team Sky with all of that controversy going on at the moment.
Yeah,
is that why
it's got, especially from Brits, you know, Brits Are Hero was Bradley Wiggins. He was the first man to win, first Brit to win the Tour de France for however, or essentially even ever, I can't quite remember. And then all of a sudden, you know, you got Chris Froome coming the next year and beating Wiggins and winning the title, and everyone's been like, and we've switched off from road cycling since Wiggins has gone, and then with all the Team Sky accusations and
TVs, all that.
Yeah,
sort of
Greg LeMond put it well in the Telegraph just before the tour started in July. The American two-time world champ, who's always been a vocal opponent of drugs, and he came out and said it's just difficult to watch Team Sky leading the pack. He said he didn't specifically mention any names. He didn't actually accuse Froome of anything. He just said he's very sceptical about Team Sky, the way they operate, and Sir Dave Brailsford and his method of operation. But then he did come out and say, you know, Froome doesn't deserve the treatment that he has been given by fans previously. It's like throwing the Euro over him in 2015 and stuff like that. I don't think he particularly thinks Froome is more guilty of doping than anyone else. It's just the whole Team Sky thing with the TUEs, and it's just a mess.
And he's the man to be caught now. He's top of the pile. He's the favourite in most races he enters. He's, I suppose, the guy to be targeted now.
Everyone is now expecting Froome to be caught for drugs at some point.
Because he's winning,
yeah.
Primarily. Such is the state of cycling at the moment.
I really hope he's clean.
So do I. But moving on to discussion number two, and surprise, surprise, it's more drugs.
We didn't talk about doping a lot on this show.
There's a lot of doping to be talked about. Joy, oh joy. This time around, it's doping and Russia again. On Thursday, the 14th of September, 17 national anti-doping organisations demanded that Russia should be banned from the upcoming 2018 Winter Olympics. The group said that the IOC's refusal to hold Russia accountable for, quote, one of the biggest scandals in sports history, imperils clean athletes and the future of the Olympic movement, end quote. The group went on to say the country must be punished for proven corruption of the Sochi 2014 Games and continuing failure in its obligations to clean sport. They also warned that they had serious doubts the Pyeongchang Games would be clean. For the record, the UK anti-doping agency was one of the 17, as was the USA. And of course, this follows on from the IOC response to Russia in the lead-up to the Rio Olympic Games, where they left the decision whether to ban Russian athletes up to the individual governing bodies. Of course, athletics had already banned Russia from competing, but other sports such as fencing, my own world, straight away allowed them to compete. Obviously, it's a shame for clean Russian athletes if that happens, but from my point of view, you need a tough, zero-tolerance response to this, because it was state-sponsored doping on a scale that we have never seen before, and a scale that we never comprehended before.
Yeah, it's the suggestion even that Russia might avoid a ban and get a fine, which someone has come out and said that's not going to happen. Actually, it was the IOC vice president, I think John Coates, who rejected a suggestion of a fine, but then he came out and said they can't implement anything until they've got all the evidence. And I'm thinking, you're never going to get all the evidence, because it was such a well run, you didn't uncover this for a while. It was such a well run thing. You're never going to get all the evidence. Surely you've got to go with what evidence you've got now and impose something, because it's 5 months of Pyeongchang 2018. You know, there's clean athletes out there who will be getting ready to compete for Russia. I haven't done anything wrong, and then all of a sudden, you know, they could be banned. And if you ban them now, you could give them the chance to prove that they're clean and compete like the athletes did at London 2017 under the authorised neutral flag. You know, I think clean athletes there are going to be clean athletes in that Russian team. They deserve the chance to be able to compete. So they need to, IOC need to do something. They need to get their asses into gear and do something now to set a precedent in saying that we're not going to accept any doping, and also give the clean athletes a chance to prove themselves and compete under that authorised neutral flag. I just wish they'd get a move on.
Yeah, there's a distinct lack of a proactive approach, I think, from the IOC. It's very much wait, and maybe it will blow over. But it's not going to blow over anytime soon, because it's one of the biggest sporting scandals we've seen for quite some time. Of course, the argument against banning them is that you're going to punish the clean Russian athletes that weren't involved in the state-sponsored doping at all. But I think you've got to ban Russia as a whole, unless you can prove that you had absolutely no, you know, links to it whatsoever, such as Russian athletes that train full-time in the US, stuff like that.
Daria Klishina, who was the only track and field athlete allowed to compete at Rio 2016, because she proved beyond all doubt, you know, she trains in the States, she does all her drug testing in the States, she's completely clean, and she was the only athlete allowed to compete. And there are athletes out there like that, and they now need to be given a chance to prove they can compete and qualify. But Russia do, on the whole, I think, need to be banned, because anything else would be a sign of weakness from the IOC.
Exactly. And even if some athletes that are totally innocent in all of this don't get to compete, granted, it's you know, devastating for them, but think how devastating it is for all those clean athletes from other countries that are competing there, but everyone is focused on Russia being there and the total mistrust with the sport right now, that all of their incredible achievements are overshadowed and they're not appreciated in the way that they should be. That's the issue here.
But when the anti-doping organisations made the statement this week, they said, you know, they're not convinced that, well, they're convinced that this is not going to be a clean Games, Pyeongchang 2018. It's already got enough worry hanging over it with the whole North Korea threat at the moment. So you know, this is just something like, all we want to do is watch sport. We don't want to be thinking, oh my god, are they doping or have they cheated? Yeah. Or we just want to watch people, you know, going headfirst down a really weird ice rink, or skating, or walking on skis. That's what we want to do.
Enjoy it, and more importantly, believe it.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. I don't know. It's hard to find the words that we can legally put out there without getting ourselves into trouble.
Because we don't want an explicit rating on this. But if you're going to deter drugs, you need to hit them hard. Financial penalties, something that will actually deter people from trying this sort of thing. And at the moment, the punishment isn't there. People will keep trying it.
The McLaren report outlining, you know, doping just from 2011 to 2015, the likelihood is this has been going on for longer than that. That came out in December. We're now in September of 2017. That's 9 months down the line, and nothing's been done.
You mentioned the New York Times article before we started recording about, of the 96 cases, 95 have been dropped because they don't have hard evidence.
Yeah, that's, I think, what encouraged these anti-doping organisations to speak out was earlier this week. They said, you know, there's the 96 athletes or 96 cases of athletes implicating in this doping programme, and they were being investigated. 95 have been closed because of a lack of hard evidence. But then you look through the McLaren report, you know, it's more than 1,000 athletes benefiting across 30 sports. You know, we've got medalists, you know, suggestions of using salt and coffee to manipulate urine samples. They actually found two female ice hockey players from Russia had male urine samples. You know, they've found the way that they were manipulating it, and, you know, like it's almost like going into a room and you've got someone under the table the tester gets distracted and you've literally got someone under the table swapping the lids on the urine samples. It's
bizarre, isn't it?
It's ridiculous, and they've almost managed to prove this. You know, they've shown it, and how you cannot have introduced some ban or even taken away the medalists from Sochi 2015, both the able-bodied and the para-athletes. So many have been implicated, and yet they've still got their medals.
Exactly. Where's the reaction? Where's the deterrent? I'm still waiting to see it.
I really want to enjoy it. I love watching the Winter Olympics because it's sports you don't see every day.
Yeah.
Even curling, it's a really gripping watch. And I love watching the luge and the bobsleigh. And all I want to do is just sit down when I get back from work, or before I go to work, or at work if they allow me, and just, you know, watch and just enjoy it for what it is, and not thinking like I was, to be honest, at London 2017. You see certain athletes like Yudama of Ethiopia, and you think doping. Just because they're better than everyone else, you don't want to think like that. And I think the only way you're going to do that is ban Russia.
It is a dark, dark cloud.
And they're not the only ones. You know, there's Kenya, Jamaica, Ethiopia are going to come under scrutiny in the near future, by the sounds of it. So, you know, Russia aren't the only ones who need to have sanctions put upon them, but they are the ones who have this state-sponsored doping program, which is quite impressive.
And in some ways, it is.
It is impressive, but also it's just, how can you allow them to compete?
And yet. So, to sum up, one word answer. Should they be banned?
Yes.
Will they be banned?
Unsure.
I'm going to say yes to the first one and no for the second one. I don't think they will.
I think politically, Russia is a big nation and you don't want to upset them.
That's the thing, it's the politics.
Also, there's a lot of other powerful nations like the UK and the US, that you, and I think Germany as well were one of these anti-doping organisations. Mm. You're going to upset them if you don't ban Russia. So, swings and roundabouts.
Yes, we will see. Come on, IOC. Get your act together.
Anyway, let's do some more uplifting stuff.
Yes, exactly, because that concludes the very drugs-based discussion section on this episode. But stick around, listeners, because, of course, it is feature interview time. And this is one of the most open, wide-ranging interviews I've ever done. And it's a big thanks to a certain Reese Prescott for taking some time out to speak to us. The 21-year-old from Walthamstow stormed onto the scene this summer as his seventh-place finish in the 100 metres at the London IAAF World Championships propelled him into the public eye. He's young, he's been professional for just 2 years, and he is now a nominee for the European Athletics Male Rising Star of 2017 award. So get retweeting, everyone, if you want him to win that. However, it could all have been very different for Reese as he almost packed in the sport a couple of years ago in its entirety. Stay tuned to find out why, and a whole lot more after this. Welcome back, everyone, to our feature interview section, where we're joined by a rising star of British athletics and British sprinting. Despite only competing professionally since 2015, 21-year-old Reese Prescott has quite literally raced through the ranks. After a barnstorming 2016 season, he announced himself to the wider British public with an excellent performance at this summer's IAAF World Championships in London, as he made it through to the 100-metre final, finishing 7th. Understandably, he has been tipped for great things, and we're delighted to say that he joins us on the phone right now. Welcome to the show, Reese. How are you?
I'm good, good. Thank you for the show. Thank you for inviting me to the show.
Well, yeah, delighted to have you. So let me start with the year 2016. At the England Athletics Championships, you ran a 10.0400 metres, which everyone obviously took notice of. And you ended up being joint fourth in the country over 100 metres and fifth over 200 metres. Mm-hmm. All that came off the back of 2 years' worth of injuries and with just 1 year of full-time training and athlete living under your belt. So in terms of your own personal development and kind of making a name for yourself as well, how important were your performances in that year?
To be fair, I think 2016 was kind of a learning curve for me. Mm-hmm. It was kind of, prior to that, I'd had a few injuries in 2014 and 2015. Just general injuries, quite similar to Usain Bolt, actually, just growing and being strong at the same time is quite tricky, being a tall sprinter, getting every part of the body strong. So I thought like 2014 and 2015 were very much just me getting stronger, spending time in the gym, just kind of learning my body and kind of learning my gym coaches what's going to get me strong and healthy. We then went for 2016 and we just said, you know, my main event then was the 200 metres. So I was a lot more focused on the 200 and started the season off well. I remember I went to Loughborough International in 20.8 and then slowly just got into the season. I think that year was European, so that was the main focus. And the qualifier was, I think, it was 2060. I ended up running 20.5 kind of mid-season and then went on to the trials. Feeling good, quite in good shape, and I ended up coming third at my first senior trials. Which was obviously a whole new experience for me, and it was a great learning curve and just being around the environment and actually running healthy. After that, I didn't get selected for Europeans, but I continued to race after that, and then my coach kind of changed the focus at 100 metres. He was like, well, obviously I've got a good finish, but if I can get my start half decent, then I feel like I can definitely challenge the big boys. And I ran my first competitive 100. I had that running maybe like 2-3 years. I ended up running 10.30 for my first race, was pretty decent. I then thought to myself, you know, I could go a bit quicker than that. Ended up going down to Bedford about 2 weeks later. It was a nice day. My coach said I had one run. I ended up running 10.04, my second 100, and it was I just got out and just went for it. And, you know, to nearly break under 10 seconds, to nearly go under 10 seconds in my second competitive 100, for me it was just like, oh, actually, I could actually be good at this event. So it was like kind of a little bit of a taster. I mean, the boys obviously, like a few of my team, my training partners were going to Rio at the time, so now obviously that like, sent a bit of a message to them, like, you know, Reese is actually, can actually do the 100 as well, it might be his new event. I then left the 100 and then ended up going back to my 200, and the flat speed from the 1 helped me for my 200 2016 kind of just laid the foundations for what 2017 was going to be.
Yeah, a learning curve and sort of a stepping stone, I suppose.
Yeah, it was kind of set up how 2017 was going, and at the end of the season, I sat down and I looked at what was the goal next year. The goal focus being either London World Champs or under-23s. I had two kind of, I had a goal A, goal B. Aiming for both of them, and just I just had to look, see what the criteria was of what. Start my season off. Ran 10-9 first race, which was the world qualifier. So it kind of just catapulted me, then ended up going to Worlds. So it's a bit of a crazy journey from 2016.
Yeah, well, it was certainly a catapult, and I suppose the key moment was the British team trials where you won the 100 metres in Birmingham, like at the start of July, I think it was.
Yeah,
which sealed your selection.
Yeah, me and my coach, we kind of make sure that anything we do prior to the championships and or trials first would be geared towards that. So I'd raced in, I'd gone to Italy, I'd raced over in Italy, ran a qualifier there, and I'd raced in Durham. I got to the Diamond League, had a bit of a waking up there, which was quite tricky, but positive. I didn't look at it negatively. I didn't think, you know, I feel out of place or take it. I came seventh. I didn't really bother. I was like, you know what, this is the kind of levels I want to race against. These guys have all probably got 10 years on me, if not, you know, they're a lot older than me, so I wasn't really fazed. Kind of took the learning curve from that, took all the lessons. So going into British Championship, I was very confident. I kind of knew I could run, you know, close to dipping under 10, and I went for that. So the first round was a heat. I kind of just got done enough to get through. I've learned not to kind of, unless it's like a well staged competition, to not kill yourself in the first run. Just do enough to get through. Watching Bolt when I was young, I've noticed he's always done enough just to get through, never really quite gone to tape each round. So I just kind of learned that and got through to the final. And in the final, like I said, it's anyone's game, just concentrate, put my head down. Ends up giving a pretty decent start was enough, and then my back end of my race is always my best part. Just came through and got the win. I mean, for everyone, like to the outside world having known me, it was a bit of a surprise for them. But if you like, obviously, if you're a big fan of Athletics, and if you are like follow Athletics quite well and statisticians, if you look on the rankings, I mean, I was ranked in the country, I think fourth. I think I was fourth or third at the time, and obviously CJ was in the final, Adam was in the final, Nathaniel obviously did the 200 metres, so the next on paper would literally be me. You were just going to go off step, so it was, I just kind of seized the opportunity and put my face in London, really.
Yeah, certainly seized your opportunity. And you're from Walthamstow, which is just a few miles away from the Olympic Stadium.
Yeah.
So how did it feel knowing that you'd be able to race in that stadium for the first time with a packed-out crowd?
Oh, amazing. Like, the London stadium was actually amazing. The crowd was good. It was full to the stands. I mean, I don't think I'm ever going to run a stadium, maybe until the next Olympics, of such a full, supportive crowd. So doing that was just an amazing achievement. I mean, I go past Stratford quite a lot. If I'm going to Westwood, I always see the stadium. If I'm driving past to go to my dad's house, I always just see what's going on there. It's just like, I said to myself, one day it could be running there, and then to put my place in London, actually be in a stadium, I mean, it was just amazing. Like, I can't really, it was just a real experience. Like, when I look back at videos and stuff, I still get goosebumps. So it was a great, great experience.
Yeah, it certainly was a great event. But going into the Worlds, did you set yourself any targets, or was it just a case of making the final, or just being focused on running as fast a race as possible and securing maybe a personal best?
For me, I just like, I've always got like keep it quite simple. I mean, each race is an opportunity to do what I need to do. I've practiced a race pattern model throughout the whole season, so that it's the same race, just like it's the same race, just in a bit of a more pressure environment. So going to it, I knew I had to be on my A game, so I just made sure I prepared the best for it. But obviously, I've never been in this environment before. This is my first time being in a championship, my first time doing three races in, you know, 24 hours, so it was all a whole new learning curve to me. But at the same time, I was just taking it by my stride, listening to the physio, the medical team. British Athletics were quite supportive and just, you know, helping me in what I need to do and giving me advice and telling me not to worry, and this is your first championship. So I felt quite relaxed. I didn't feel like, you know, if I didn't do what I needed, if I didn't, you know, run this well or that, I wouldn't have, like, everyone would kind of be disappointed in me. I felt quite, you know, supported from everyone, really. Which is a really good thing. I mean, even like, obviously I was sponsored by Nike as well, and they were just like, enjoy it and go and just show your talent, really. So it was just, for me, it was just great to actually just take each round. I took the first round, took the second round. By the time I got to the final, I was tired. I'd run this in nearly two PBs in 2 days, so it was quite a new challenge for me, but I just kind of literally just gave it my all. Obviously, it wasn't enough to kind of, you know, get a medal or between the Olympics in 2020, I just want to definitely, like, each year just get better and better and really start to make my mark later on next year and just come in and just show everybody that, you know, I can be a good competitive sprinter and train well and, you know, inspire people, really.
Yeah, and certainly listen to you, that sort of taste of that first major championship and competing with that level of quality, has it given you like an extra added bit of hunger, really, to really be the best?
Definitely, I mean, for me, like, it's obviously new and it's everyone's excited and obviously I'm doing, like, people are, you know, I'm doing quite well now and it's just, it's a whole kind of different feeling, but at the same time, I've got to kind of enjoy the successes and stuff, but then I've got to keep my head down and go back to where I remember what got me there and apply the same work ethic that I've had for the last couple of years when no one's known me, and, you know what I mean? So I kind of always try to think back to my dark times and just when I was, you know, at home by myself and not really knew me that much and I was getting on the training, so it's that mentality of training hard and that will get you to where you need to go. So I feel like I'll just, as soon as, you know, season starts back, I'll just use to do whatever I need to do and train, put my body in line and train as hard as I can to achieve what I need to achieve. So it's nice now, like, I'm enjoying being off season and stuff, but as soon as work comes back, straight on, like, full guns blazing.
You mentioned the dark times there. What do you mean by that? And is athletics, kind of, did that kind of pull you out of that, maybe?
But for me, when I say dark times, I mean, like, for me, obviously, I've been injured for nearly two, 3 years. And being, you know, being 50, being, like, 16, 17, it's quite hard, it's quite tough. Like, all my friends that I know, my training partners are, you know, going to World Youths, World Juniors, European Juniors, and I'm at home missing those events, you know what I mean? It wasn't the nicest thing, you know. I had that stigma, oh, Reese is good, but he always gets injured, and it was just tricky because you're not kind of in the system, you're not kind of in the game, you're kind of just outside kind of thing, and it was just finding a team of people that can help me, and then once we got everything right, and obviously now it's a lot better, but it's just, I feel like sometimes you, like, when you haven't got everything, and we haven't got all the comforts, you kind of learn a lot about yourself, and you learn what it takes to actually, you know, grind and work hard, and those moments have kind of helped me now, so I see both sides, if you know what I'm saying. I see when I'm running well, everything's going fine, I'm running PBs, I'm, you know, the next hope, but then I'll be on the other side when I know it's not going well, and it's just so, I learn from both sides, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, and I suppose when you get labelled with that sort of injury prone tag, once you come back after an injury, is a large part of it trying to convince yourself that you're not going to do any more damage to yourself once you push?
For me, I don't know, I think with sprinting, you have to, you're going to push your body to the limit anyway. So, like, you never can really, you know, be completely injury free, but, like, it's just managing those injuries.
And the self-doubt as well, maybe.
Yeah, like, you have mental doubt, but that's just trusting yourself again. Like, anything's fixable with the right effort, given the flex, and you've got a good team around you, it's fine. Like, obviously for me, this year I've had British Athletic medical team behind me, so they've kind of checked my body, keep my body healthy, and it's been a really, like, par touch with anything, nothing major's happened, but I managed to finish the season healthy, so in my first time in a couple of years. So it's literally just a matter of having the right team around you, being confident, and, you know, it's not just going to the gym or training hard, it's okay, you've trained hard, but what are you doing to recover? What are you doing? Like, what are you eating? Are you sleeping well? Are you committed there? You know what I mean? Like, people don't, there's a lot more than just, you know, just turn up to training that goes behind it. And so I feel like it's being on top of those things as well, like the nutrition, the sleep, the recovery strategies. That's the difference in world-class athletics as well. So,
yeah, that's something that always gets mentioned to me by other athletes, regardless of sport as well, is that the support behind them from other people, coaches, family, is always so important as well.
Yeah, it's massive. So I feel like that's played a big part of me this year, and I've kind of made sure that I've kept on point with it and discipline with it.
Mm-hmm. I also wanted to delve a little further into that 100-metre final at the World Championships a bit more, because naturally all eyes, I suppose, were on Usain Bolt in that final, because, of course, he was bowing out afterwards. And, of course, the result was a shock to some people, with Bolt coming third and Gatlin winning. And Gatlin's pass is obviously well known, and the crowd's reaction is a huge talking point. So as someone that was part of that race, firstly, what did you make of the result? But what did you think about the crowd's reaction?
Well, for me, for me, athletics is athletics. Like at the end of the day, we all start at the same level. At the same point, the gun goes, so the finish first is a winner. That's kind of I kind of look at it like that. Obviously, everyone would have, obviously the fairy tale story would have been Bolt would have won, and then Dada and would have been retired. However, if you look at it, Gatlin has been running well this year. Coleman has been running extremely well this year, so there were a lot of guys that's going to challenge Bolt. And I feel like it just came down to who was better at that moment. Do you know what I mean? So, like when I was in the state, it was a weird feeling because it was like there was so much going on at the finish line. I mean, Bolt was obviously celebrating his lap of honour because it was his last race. Gatlin was obviously happy because he won. Yeah, and the crowd booed and the crowd was cheered. It was just a weird experience to be in. Like, it was quite surreal to be fair. But I didn't know what to make of it because normally when I finish racing, everyone just claps and that's it. So it was quite a weird experience, but in my head, I kind of was focused on what I was doing, and if I was to throw money on anyone based on the body language and the environment we're calling my undergun, to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
Just in how focused he was, how engaged he was. And Gatlin's been there. He's kind of been there before, and I feel like last World Champs he just missed out from with composure, and this World Champs he just got it right.
Exactly. Fine lines.
Yeah, and I was obviously next to him, and like next to me, and when the gun went, it was off, completely off. Like set, go, like chance to run him down, but I don't think my legs have got that yet. But I'll give it a couple of years, hopefully be able to.
Oh yeah, exactly, give it a couple of years. And that brings me perfectly onto the man himself, Usain Bolt, who I believe was one of your idols growing up. What was it like getting to compete alongside him before he retired? And did you get to have much interaction with him? Did you get to speak with him?
This is the first time he's obviously got involved. Like, this is my first time. That was the first race I've actually raced against him. But the way he's put Felix on the map has been very good. And it's also just helped. The sport completely, I feel like. But I don't know, like when I was in the corner, he said, "Good luck, kid." Like, so he said, "Well done for being here, well done for getting here," which was quite a nice thing to hear before the race, obviously.
Yeah.
But isn't that Bolt is obviously a nice guy, like he's trained hard, he's worked hard, he's shown the world his true potential and his ability. And it was unfortunate that he didn't bow, but it was that's just athletics. You can't be on top forever, everyone. New people would always come through, and it's just part of the game, really. But in terms of, you know, like his legacy, he's laid a legacy, and it's just now the thing was before you'd know Bolt was going to win, whereas now when you watch 100 meter race, you're not going to know who's going to win, which would be very interesting. But you can't really call it just, oh, he's the favourite, if you know what I mean. So, which I think is like much better. And we've seen this year, like obviously my training partner, CJ's obviously going to win the Diamond League this year, and it's just showing you that on anyone's day, you get it right, you get it right. So it's just, I feel like with us, there's a new crop of British sprinters coming up, and I feel like it's going to be a lot more competitive this year. I don't think the Americans and the Jamaicans are going to dominate it as much. I feel like Britain has got a good crop of guys now that can really challenge the world.
Yeah, exactly, and you saw that at the Worlds when they won the 4x100 as well.
Yeah, really.
CJ, Adam Jamili, yeah.
I was sad for him. Like, obviously, I've literally just joined the team, like, newly joined the team. So for me, like, it's all new and all the stuff with the band. Everyone's asking, why didn't you run? I would have loved to run, but I'm literally learning it, and I feel like in a pressure environment, I defend with more experience than me to run it. But at the same time, I don't know, they caught it on BBC, but I literally was in the stadium cheering. I managed to get down to them after they finished, which is amazing. And I was just so happy for the boys. I mean, I've seen, obviously, I've stopped practice all season, and to get it right, we need to get it right in front of a home crowd. I mean, we couldn't ask for more. So I feel like it's just shown that, you know, when British guys actually get the young group get it right, it just works well. And I feel like building into the future, there's going to be loads of us. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, with places and stuff. But I don't think there's no, like, you know, animosity or any negativity within the team. Everyone's positive, and it's just a nice environment. Like, if you run, you run. If you don't, you just don't. And it's literally just a bit of a family now, which I really like. So it's kind of like made me look forward to the future. And obviously, I'm going to be one of the older guys, and the younger guys come through just to kind of to show them the same thing that I've learned as well. So I feel like the next couple of years is going to be really positive, just for myself and collectively as British sprinting. I think it's going to get better.
Yeah, it certainly seems like exciting times ahead. I also wanted to talk about your similarities with Bolt are quite striking, namely in that you're, as you've mentioned before, you're quite a tall gentleman at 6'4". Bolt, 6'5". And he almost rewrote the rule book on kind of what a 100-metre runner stature should be, really.
Yeah.
And I read a piece about you in Athletics Weekly when you said that you'd always been shunned away from the 100 metres and told to do 200 or 400 because of your height. Do you now consider yourself more of a 100 metre specialist? And what is it about that distance you prefer?
Well, obviously, being in the making the final of 100 metres, I definitely would call myself a 100 metre runner. But I feel like it's just, people have always, you know, put me, like you said, they said, oh, you'd be amazing at the 2, amazing at the 4, because you're so tall. Like, but to me, in my head, I feel like upright sprinting, bolts obviously showing like top end speed is good. So for someone like myself, and there's a few other tall sprinters that have the top end speed, it's actually just a matter of getting the start right, really. And I haven't had a long, really mastering the 200. I've spent the last kind of 3 years focusing on the 200 metres. So I've also got a lot to work on with my start, but I feel like being my first year as a 100 metre runner, I feel like building on, I can definitely build on more. I feel like can take a bit, you know, go into indoors. And indoors is the perfect opportunity to practice my start. I mean, all the guys are quite short, obviously quite of a shorter stature. They can get to 60 metres really quick. So for me, this is a perfect environment to practice my start and practice what it's like, you know, getting out of the blocks quickly. Because I know in my head, if I'm next to you after 50 metres, 60 metres, I can run most people down, if you know what I mean. So I'm not necessarily worried about the latter end of the race, just make sure I get out of the gun. So I feel like Bolt's obviously shown the way to a tall sprinter to be, and obviously me and my coach have looked at that, how, you know, the stature, the size, the strength you need to be able to do that, and it's just a matter of building towards that each year. So I feel like I'm definitely on the path to building that.
Mm-hmm. And are you tempted to give 400 a go, or give 200 the same sort of focus?
I've made it back into 200s occasionally. Like, I do that 200 metres sometimes, but nothing. I feel like my focus is going to be on 100 metres for now. Mm-hmm. The 400 metres is a great event, but the training for 400 metres is absolutely, it's horrible. Horrible. I'm quite comfortable doing the 100 metres at the moment. The straight line kind of, it's easier for me to stay healthy in a straight line than it is start going around bends and corners and stuff. So I think me and my coach want to stick to 100 metres for a while.
Yeah, and it certainly seems to be going all right so far.
Yeah.
But, and your 2017 season is all finished up now. Have you taken much of a break? Have you gone on holiday?
I kind of just been at home. I'm like, some of my friends, I've come back to the end of the season, I'm touching up with them. Spent a bit of time with family. I kind of booked myself up in like a few spas and stuff just to chill out. Going to like a few events and stuff. So nothing really like a major break. I still want to kind of come in once a week and train and keep myself healthy. And remember that I've got another year to go and there's going to be new goals. I'll start pre-seasons in about 2 weeks, just to kind of get back strength, just general fitness, and then once that's done, kind of get back on the training, really.
Yeah, and people will undoubtedly be keen to see where you go from here. So what, have you set yourself a new target in terms of competing, or is like sub 10 maybe the next thing on the agenda?
Yeah, for me, I don't, like with time and stuff, I don't really look at that. Like, I just look at, we look at, me and my coach look at the race and what could be better in the race, and with the race time come, we don't like saying, oh, we want to run, you know, 998 or 997. We just say, okay, we need to get this bit better, this bit better in there, because I don't know, my coach doesn't like to set limits on me. He just likes to keep me, okay, can I get better, can this get better? And whatever the goal is, it will take a certain thing to actually achieve that. So, you know, if you want to win, like, let's just say, World Champs or Olympics, you know you're going to have to go and run 10 low, 9999, if you see what I'm saying, to win that. Like, you know, that's the minimum. So we kind of just look at it like that. Like, if I want to go and win this thing, what would I have to do? And then it's kind of look at it from there, really. So we don't really, like, you really say, okay, I want you to run 9.9 next, sub 10 this year. We just say, you need to get stronger here, you need to get stronger there. We need to keep this good, keep that good, and then it will just come. Like, I'm not really bothered about, you know, running sub 10. I'm just trying to get the 10.0. Like I said, I said to myself, this year, if I can get 10.0 consistent, I'll be happy with that. Next year, I can get, you know, the 10 flat, and then hopefully 9.9 consistent. That'll be great. But yeah, it takes time. It's hard, you know, you're pushing the body to the end limit, so it's quite a tricky thing. But I feel like within the next couple of years, I'll definitely be able to get it right.
Yeah, the progression, I'm sure.
I'm not trying to rush, you know, bring ahead a thing in the past of, you know, being really good juniors and not great seniors. We're trying to kind of write a new curve, just progression each year.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go back as well, back in time somewhat and ask how you first got into athletics and what was it about the sport that kind of grabbed you straight away?
For me, it was... I've literally done every sport. Like, you couldn't name a sport that I haven't done. Like, I've done tennis. My dad's into tennis quite a lot. He's a bit of tennis coach. I've done tennis. I've done basketball to the point where I've ended up having trials for England. I've done football. I've done a bit of football as well. Like, I've always been quite sporty. So I remember, like, I ended up doing sports day at my school. Coming to school in Devon and in Loughran. So we used to have, like, a sports day every year. Like, a proper field and everything, and mark out 100 metres. I remember, like, the last year I came first in that, and everyone was like, oh, you're actually quite quick. And then, from then, I went home, I told my mum, I want to get into athletics. She was like, oh, okay. There's a club locally. I ended up coming to Lee Valley Athletics Centre, which was, like, 10 minutes down the road for me. CJ was there, OJ was there. So it was quite a little, there was a decent group, and then from there, we kind of just went up the ranks slowly. Like, you know, county, oh, we're doing nationals now, we're coming third in nationals, oh, actually, and then I remember, I ended up going to, after the end of 2012, I got my first medal at nationals, I came second in 200 metres, and there was an opportunity to go to an athletics academy, where you kind of, like, residentially done your studies at the same time, Oakland College in St Albans, so I ended up going there for my throughout college years, throughout the last 3 years, prior to 2016, so, like, 2014, I went there, and, learned to learn what it was like to train full time, in terms of gym, support, S&C. In that first year, I was 16, I won the under 20 nationals indoors and outdoors for 200 metres. So I kind of, when I'd done that, obviously being at such a young age, I kind of realised, well, I have a talent in this game, I just need to get better and better, really. And from there, it kind of propelled, like, I got put on a British Athletics Futures programme, obviously got injured, got taken off the programme, went back on the programme. But yeah, so just, I kind of just progress from there, really.
Yeah, you can always feel the talent is there somewhere, just waiting.
Yeah, it's there, like, it's just there, literally. And obviously, I was in a bit of a situation where I was getting quite upset, and it was just kind of hard. And I ended up speaking to my coach, and then my coach got in touch with Nike, and then I kind of had a chat with Nike, and I had a meeting with Nike, and sat down with Nike, and kind of just expressed, like, I feel like, you know, I'm really talented, but support wasn't really there for me, and it was just like, I felt like it was quite hard for me. That was quite a hard time. I was quite like, you know, athletics, there's not much support in athletics. How am I gonna, you know, become great? And Nike just gave me a chance. They just gave me, they said, you know what, like, we can see this, we can help you out. And they gave me, like, a 2-year junior contract, which really, really helped me. Just good contract with, like, goals and stuff, and just to be able to, you know, we think you can achieve this, can you achieve that? And it kind of just gave me a real incentive. And being part of a brand like Nike, obviously they've got, like, the world's best in every kind of sport. So it was, like, really inspirational, you know, going to football games, going to events, meeting people, and it just kind of made me feel part of, like, actually, you know, you can actually achieve well. And the last 2 years, obviously, I've obviously achieved quite a lot. So having that support behind me is really, you know, tell me it's inspirational and makes me take the sport really seriously. I mean, I look at the guys like Kobe Bryant, Kobe Bryant, Federer's there as well, so I kind of just look at them quite a lot, which is, like, I kind of aspire to be, like, a great in my sport, but I take kind of that attitude of, you know, working hard and excelling and doing the best you can, which I think is a really good attitude for me to have, and it just, from there, it's kind of got me into athletics and kind of kept me working hard, so it's pretty good.
And it's high praise that Nike are willing to give you that support, because they can see, like, what you're capable of as well.
That's the thing. It was good for them. Clearly they said, no, you know, we don't let you, know what I mean, but they, you know, it's about me, help me, give me support. I was really grateful for, and obviously now I've obviously over-excelled, so we've got a great relationship there, man.
Yeah, so where do you think you'd be if you hadn't been able to get that support from Nike?
If I'm honest, I probably would be working in the estate agent, I reckon.
Really?
Yeah, I reckon I was very close. I had a job interview for quite a few estate agents. I was very close to doing that, very close. I kind of like property and was quite good at, like, you know, like, negotiating and sales and stuff. So I was heading down that road. I had a job in a bar in Essex, like a golf club. So I was working behind a bar there as well. So it was just, I thought I would have just got a full-time job locally somewhere.
And just run in your spare time?
Yeah, maybe in the evenings, but even then I probably would end up just sacking it off and just working full-time.
So that, that support really came in at the right moment then, didn't it?
Literally, lifesaver.
Blimey. And while I also have you, I wanted to ask you about a couple of the wider issues in athletics at the moment. The first being doping, something I've written far too much about for my liking in recent times. And a lot of the viewing public say they can't trust what they see on track a lot of the time. Do you find it disheartening that cheaters in your sport have effectively tarnished the reputation of clean athletes in the sport as a whole?
It's kind of put like a dark cloud on the sport, really, truthfully. Which isn't great. I feel like it's hard because obviously, like with obviously British athletics and being a British athlete in Europe, I'm the World Anti-Doping Agency, like they have like a thing called WADA, and they have like a thing called Adams, which means I have to like track my whereabouts, and I'll get being tested quite a lot. And it's just like, you know, for athletes that are doing it clean, for you know, someone just to brashly say, oh, you know, it's not legitimate, or they're like, they haven't woke up at 7 a.m. and had someone knock on their door asking to go to the toilet. Do you know what I mean? So it's like it's a wider issue, but for me, you know, I just trust in SEBCO that will sort it out, and trust in, you know, the World Anti-Doping Agency that they can just get, you know, good offices in all over the world and just test athletes. So then when it comes to this competition, everyone's fairly and it's all equal. That's what I can really hope for. I can't, you know, say I can't really, you know, tarnish that person or tarnish that running name pick. You know what I mean? It's just, it's what it is. I keep up to date my whereabouts. I, you know, I take my tests, I make sure my supplements are batch tested, and, you know, so I can't really, I can't really comment. Do you know what I mean? That's just nothing really. I do my part, and I hope that everyone else in the world does their part. Really, like, at the end of the day, like if you want to cheat and you can and it lives on you and you can sit well down your conscience, then fair enough on you. But for me, I couldn't do that. I train too hard, and you know, to work and just pride and just my family, and I inspire quite a lot of young athletes and go to school as well. Exactly. In my borough, and I'm a sports ambassador in my borough, so I'd always kind of like to uphand a good standard, and you know, cheating is never part of that standard, so for me I keep clean, but it's just some people obviously see a different way to get there, which isn't good. So hopefully we just hope that SEBCO will sort it out, and obviously the one that don't change the seat will just keep doing what they're doing, working hard, and just get the cheats out, really.
Yeah, and one measure that was proposed back in May by European Athletics was to erase all the world records set before 2005. Is that the right way of going about it to restore the trust in your eyes?
I don't think so, to be fair, because I feel like at that time, there were obviously individuals that, you know, that could have been deemed as guilty, but obviously people that were clean at the same time, just like me, but people like me, they've obviously trained hard and, you know, looked to achieve those things and done that, and I feel like I shouldn't be erased or wiped. I feel like just the same way we have, you know, I have whereabouts in here. I feel like that should just be the case all over the world, and that way there would be no kind of real issue with it. But obviously there's different tactics and different people trying to imply different things, but I don't think erasing a record before a certain time would, because if you were to rate, like, let's just say 100 meters, if you were to erase the records from before that, most of the records came later on, like Bolt, you know what I mean? Bolt came, what, 2008, 2009, so it wasn't. And for me, like, I like having such a goal out there, if you know what I mean, to aspire to.
Yeah, that pinnacle target, if you like.
It wouldn't help the sport, because everyone would be, it'll be a new world record every week, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of lose the meaning behind the achievement.
Yeah, fully.
Yeah, and well, with that, I suppose we better wrap up, and I just want to say a big thanks again for joining us, Reece. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and you speak incredibly well about your sport, and I'm sure a load of other people will be inspired to follow up what you do, and I'm sure, we'll keep track of your career along the way. So many thanks for joining us. All the best.
Thank you very much. I look forward to reading the article and seeing what it's like. Thank you very much, mate.
Well, we'd just like to thank Reece again for taking part in that interview. I certainly enjoyed it, and I hope everyone else enjoyed listening to him, because he's such a great speaker on this sport. But for now, before we leave you, it's housekeeping notes. First off, Sportsbill is now available on Stitcher. So if you want to listen there instead of SoundCloud or iTunes, then you can go right ahead. And of course, you can follow us on social media.
That's SportsBillPod on Facebook, Twitter, and on Instagram. And you can email us feedback at sportsbillpod@gmail.com. That's all from me, I think, this week. Have you got anything to add?
No.
Anything you want to say?
I might have got my arse in gear and got myself an interview for the next podcast.
Ooh, stay tuned in a couple of weeks for that.
So that will be that promises to be quite an interesting one. It's a sport we don't know in the mainstream a lot about, but in the next few years, this potentially could be a rising star. So
ooh, cliffhanger.
That'll be a good one to wait for, I think.
Well, that doesn't tease you enough. We'll see you in 2 weeks, everyone. Right. Have fun.